Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to season 4, episode 7.
Hi. Oh,
lucky number 7. Spooky number 7.
Spooky.
This is going to be a real spooktastic episode, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
We have double ghosties. It's going to be a good one. Welcome to Resolve Mysteries. This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Eliza.
And welcome to our show. As most of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And this month's organization is the Epilepsy Foundation, recommended by our patron, Ruth. So thanks, Ruth. And we have one sweetie to shout out today. And I'll just shout it out.
Yeah.
Seems weird to pass it off to someone else for this.
Uh-huh.
Shout out to Danielle Kay. Thanks so much for your patronship.
Thank you, honey.
Oh, honey.
If you'd like to support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks and some other things sometimes, and goodies in the mail. And we now have a new option for patrons to pay for an entire year instead of paying monthly. And if you do that, you get 10% off. And that discount lasts until August 1st.
Woohoo!
Worth it.
Do it.
All right, everybody, what are we talking about in this epi?
Oh, boy. Well, the first spook segment is the St. James Hotel.
Ooh.
And then the second spook segment is the Hardin House. And since this is 4 segments, that's going to be part 1.
Yeah.
And then in part two
starts with a missing segment about Marianne Perez.
And then it ends with a fraud segment of Dr. John Anderson.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right, y'all, it's a spooky summer.
Yes, it is.
We were just discussing
Halloween in July.
Mm-hmm. Cryptids and ghosts. It's going to be awesome.
So, Stack opens this whole episode, which was aired right around Halloween time on October 30th, and he says, "Tomorrow brings the one night which seems to bring out the wide-eyed child in all of us, Halloween. As darkness falls, our imaginations take flight. Houses begin to whisper and creak. Shadows come to life. The sky fills with ghosts and goblins." So this first segment is about the haunted St. James Hotel.
Ooh.
Ooh. So the St. James Hotel was a very popular saloon near what is called the Santa Fe Trail in Cimarron, New Mexico. And Cimarron's actually about 2 hours away from Santa Fe, but there was a Santa Fe Trail that many Western legends used and also frequented the hotel. Jesse James, Annie Oakley, Doc Holliday, Billy the Kid, Wyatt Earp, they all visited.
Just to name a few.
Love it.
And many of them visited the hotel more than one time. So it was built in 1871 and experienced a lot of history, but eventually it fell into disrepair until 1985 when we see Ed Sitzberger. And I can't remember if Stack says it or just in the reading on the fandom site, but they call the woman his wife, Patricia. But from what I can find, they're brother and sister.
Oh. Big diff.
Okay.
And she's actually, her title card says Patricia Lori, not Patricia Sitzberger. Not that she couldn't have had a different name from him, but I'm guessing that's her married name because she's married to someone else. Yeah. So, okay. I don't know.
Meaning not her brother.
Yeah. I found things later that showed, like, she had a brother named Ed Sitzberger. So I'm sure.
Weird.
Yeah. That's definitely her brother, right?
Okay.
Good job, Ewan.
Okay. So they bought the St. James Hotel in 1985 and hoped to restore it. So we see them, we see Patricia during a rainy night with a friend at the hotel, and she's putting buckets around to find out how many leaks there actually are that they'll need to fix. So this thing's like truly no one has been using it for a while.
Well, and it's like the beginning of every scary movie where they move into this old house and they're putting buckets around and the shit's,
seriously. Yeah. And of course it's raining outside. Yes. Of course it is.
It must be.
So they're putting the buckets around. They turn off all the chandeliers and they go outside and they turn around and it's pouring down rain and they look up in the window and one chandelier is turned on again. So they both go inside. They turn the chandelier off. They hear the click. When they go back outside, of course, the chandelier is on again. So Patricia has to go in and turn the chandelier off two more times. And finally, she remembers something that the previous owners had told them that they had to do at times. And we see her say, "I don't know who you are or why you're here, but I don't want to play anymore and I want to go home. I'm really tired. Can we play another time?" And she turns the chandelier off. She goes outside and it didn't turn back on.
Also, she is inviting more haunting activity.
You hear about that, though. You hear about, like, them talking to the spirits to get them to go away or say, like, leave this room or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yes. I know. I've always been creeped out by that, actually. It's almost scarier to acknowledge it. Yeah, exactly. Can we reschedule this play date? Thank you. So she says that she heard the click of the chandelier each time she turned it off. You know, you're pulling that string.
Yes.
Like, she's like, there's no way it could have just turned itself back on. So the Sitzbergers claim that the entire hotel is haunted, and Stack says, quote, top to bottom. And we see some guests reenacting their stay in room 17, where people have reported that whenever the window is open, there's a mysterious, very fast-paced tapping sound that continues until they get up and close the window. And that's happened to several guests, apparently. Then we see some amazing 90s TV trickery with a floating glass that a cook in the kitchen of the St. James Hotel looks over and sees just a levitating restaurant glass.
Full General Wayne vibes.
Yes. 100, yes. Especially in that kitchen.
Yeah.
Yep.
He was not alarmed. He just looked at it.
Oh, yeah. He just looked over. Yeah, I have a picture of it.
Hmm, That's weird.
There's that glass again. In May of 1988, Charlie Varela, who is a talking head, is a local high school student who is working his ass off cleaning the bar at 5 a.m.
Yes!
What a honey.
I know.
So he's vacuuming, and then he goes to get some garbage can liners, and when he comes back, he sees the back of a boy sitting on the bar, like spinning a glass for fun. And he says, you can hear the glass spinning. UM tries to film such a thing happening. And then he says he thought, like, oh, it was just a boy from upstairs who was staying here. And he said he walked over to him about to say, like, hey, you can't be playing down here. And when the child turns around, his face was glowing blue. And Charlie describes the face as hideous.
No. Okay. I rewound it 3 times and watched it 3 times because the first time I just saw a kid's face and I was dying laughing because he said it was hideous.
I know. Like, imagine being that actor. I know.
But the third time I realized UM had so many filters and weird lights on him that you couldn't see. They had done like a prosthetic.
Yeah,
they gave really? Him, like, a disfigured face.
They gave him a disfigured face on half of his face.
Oh, I didn't even see that. And I watched it a few times.
They did too much crap, like lighting
wise. Yes, it was so blown out that it just looked like a face. Yeah. So I know. Like, ouch.
Charlie's like, look at that ugly ass kid.
I know.
They should have ugged that kid up a little more, but I guess they tried
really
to. So poor Charlie says, I quit that morning. Seeing that scared me, and I didn't want to work here anymore.
Poor Charlie. Yeah, he was just like, that's a big nope. I am out.
Yeah, I'm out. I'm waking up at 4 a.m. to come be haunted? I don't think so. So then, amateur ghost hunter, oh boy, who among us is not an amateur ghost hunter?
I certainly am.
Who in this room?
Dr. Kenneth Wright visited the hotel to try to help the owners figure out what was going on. And when he and Patricia entered one room, they saw a strange glowing ball up in the corner, like in the sky or in the air. And Kenneth Wright says, quote, there was this anger and hatred, and instantly I was filled with terror. I was gasping for breath because I had not been expecting it. I have never been that terrified in my life. And then Patricia says to the orb, she loves talking to them. She loves talking to them.
She really does.
she's
like, we can always talk it out. It's okay.
Yes. Come to the red table. She says, you can go. You're free to go. And the orb sort of flies around the room, comes really close to them, but then goes back up to the corner and doesn't leave.
And those effects were fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. So then a psychic named Jackie Littlejohn also investigated the hotel, and she saw a vision of a poker game. So she's actually like seeing people in old-timey clothes, and she got the sense that in the poker game there was a lot at stake. So she then sees a man get up from the table and start walking down the hallway, and she thinks that he's just won, and he's actually just won the whole hotel. In the game. So as he walks down the hall, she sees another man come out and shoot him. And he's shot and he has to drag himself to his room. So she's seeing all this and she believes that the man is named T.J. Wright. So the Sitzbergers, who have the old registry from the 1800s for the hotel, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. It's always amazing to see like old Western cowboys had like beautiful calligraphy handwriting.
Yes, they always do, honey.
How?
Always masters of calligraphy.
Amazing. So they checked the registry, which they kept locked away. So they didn't think there was any way Jackie Littlejohn could have seen this name. And they found a man named T.J. Wright who had stayed at the hotel 3 different times in 1881.
Mm.
So she believes he dragged himself to his room and he died in there. Mm. So
she just had a feeling that was his name. How did she get that was his name?
Yeah.
She saw it in her mind's eye.
She had a feeling. Yeah.
She was a very stylish queen.
Oh, she's a queen. I have a little bit more on her.
I loved her. You know what? I'm buying what you're selling because your look. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm digging what I'm looking at.
I'm a sucker for packaging, and I just loved her. I loved her.
She's just convinced. Gorgeous, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to say that when you were talking about the blue orb in the hotel, the thing that cracked me up was then the scientist was like, well, it got mad when she said he could go. It was like, you go. This is my hotel.
Yes.
Honey, he stumbled over his words.
I know. It was so freaking cute. It was cute.
Good job bringing that up because he brings that up before this Jackie Littlejohn thing. Mm-hmm. But they clearly, like, cut it in a weird way because he's talking about T.J. Wright. He's saying that that orb was T.J. Wright, who had just won the hotel.
So he's like, don't tell me to leave.
He literally, like, the belief is that T.J. Wright haunts the hotel, and he's like, I won it in that poker game. I'm not leaving. All of you have to leave. That's the belief.
I love a ghosty like that. I love a crabby ghosty. Like, don't give me a nice ghosty. Crabby. I need a crabby ghosty.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was truly like, I don't leave.
Kill me once, shame on you. Kill me twice, I don't think so. Get the fuck out of my hotel.
So then Sweetie Stack says, literally acknowledges that what we've just heard is insane. He says, these firsthand counts we have just heard are definitely hard to believe. But if you can offer a better explanation for what goes on in that old hotel, the folks at the St. James would certainly like to hear it. And that's the end of the segment. So of course it ends there. It's like I could go in 8,000 different directions.
Yes. I'm sorry for you.
Well, don't worry, because I was able to watch part of another show that featured the St. James Hotel called Ghost Adventures.
Ghost Adventures!
Which is, we've all seen it. We all love it. It's very sensationalized. It's honestly very scary if you watch it at night.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't watch it at night. It's scary.
But it's called Ghost Adventures.
Yeah.
Whee! That sounds very friendly.
Yeah. It's not. It's scary because they edit it in a really creepy way with weird voices, and everyone's like crooked all the time. Like when they're doing talking heads, they like turn the camera and it's just creepy.
Honey,
like the editing.
You hate a disorienting camera angle.
Honey,
yeah, you do hate it.
You do. Cannot abide it.
And I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to scare me, and it's working, which makes me mad. So I only watched half of this episode because it
too
was
scared.
Honestly, the host, it was so ridiculous. The main guy, I forget his name, was so ill when they filmed this. He had to wear sunglasses the whole time because his eyes were like swollen shut.
Oh, why?
He's like, ew. This is the sickest I've ever been for a recording, and it might ruin our whole investigation.
Take a personal day, bro.
And then he's shaking people's hands that he's interviewing. Obviously, this is a pre-COVID time, but I'm like,
contagion.
This is disgusting. So anyway, you can watch this episode of Ghost Adventures if you have Discovery Plus. And it's definitely sensationalized like they all are. But they did talk to a few of the more current employees. This episode was from 2014. So that was kind of interesting to see.
Oh, cool.
So two of the housekeepers had a few instances that were frightening for them. Like they were cleaning one of the rooms and a remote just flew off the dresser onto the bed. And then
the ghost is like, I don't want to watch this.
Change it.
I hate Ghost Adventures.
Change the channel. And then another one was in the bathroom cleaning and looked up to see a very tall cowboy shadow in one of the bathrooms. And then she said when she came out, her coworkers were like, said she was just completely white from being so scared.
What does a cowboy shadow look like?
Just what you'd think.
Clearly
just
a cowboy hat.
Yeah, it's just okay.
That's and maybe it. Like two little mustache tips coming out besides.
Sure. If it's long enough.
The spurs by the feet where the feet would be like two little spurs sticking out.
Exactly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I just needed a picture. Thank you.
Yeah.
So then they describe a guest who claimed to not believe in the ghost, TJ. And someone like at the bar or the front desk, they were like, we're going to go up to our room, the guest. And someone at the front desk was like, oh, okay, don't let TJ mess with you, kind of joking. And the guest said, oh, I don't believe in ghosts. And then apparently the guest was thrown down the stairs, picked up and thrown down the stairs.
Oh, TJ's pissed.
TJ is mad. People heard her scream, and she had to be hospitalized for a head injury. But also, she might have just fallen down the stairs. I don't know.
Also just a ghost named TJ.
I know. I gotta look up his full... He does have a full name. Thomas something. Okay, so then one other person they talked to was a line cook who he and his father both worked at the hotel, or maybe still work there. And he claimed that one day when he was working in the kitchen, he felt a burning sensation on his back. And when he lifted up his shirt to check, there were three like claw scratch marks on his back. And the show does show a picture of the scratch marks on his back. Oh. And then he and his father claim that after that, he brought the spirits home with him, and they were messing with him and his father at their house, too.
Oh, my.
That's what they say on the show.
That's intense.
And then that's about when I stopped watching, because then they do all their, like, science stuff, like, look, there's this, if we use this certain camera, then we can see this figure, and it's like, ugh, I hate that shit.
We know you do. Oh, you hated it in Shroud of Turin, too. You were like, yeah. Fuck this science. I hate science.
Don't understand it. Famously hate science, so. Just kidding. So, just a few more things on the St. James Hotel. One interesting thing about the man that built the hotel, his name was Henri Lambert, and he later changed his name to Henry.
Oh, come on.
I know.
Henri is so much better.
He was originally Abraham Lincoln's personal chef.
Cool.
And he was recommended to Lincoln from Ulysses S. Grant.
What? Oh, my God.
So he was his personal chef until Lincoln died in 1865, and then Henry made his way west in search of gold and eventually settled near Cimarron in New Mexico and built the saloon, which he then later made rooms in, too, to make it a hotel.
Cool.
Wow.
Eventually, Henry Lambert's sons in the early 1900s, Fred and Jean, they replaced the roof on the inn, which was called Lambert Inn at that time, okay. And they found more than 400 bullet holes in the ceiling above the bar. Because this hotel is believed to be the site of at least 26 murders, maybe more.
Oh, well, no fucking wonder it's haunted. That's a lot of mad ghosts, baby.
And so, like, legend around the area is sort of like, oh, yeah, people used to get their news by just asking, so who died at the Lambert Inn last night and things like that.
Can you imagine, like, walking in there for the first time and you look up at the ceiling and you're like,
okay. Yes. And so if you go today in the dining room, you can still see 22 bullet holes.
Whoa. Oh man. God. That is so cool. I love the West. I love the Wild West.
Dang, it's wild.
It's wild. The Wild West.
The Wild West.
Yeah. So that room 17 is an area that I talked about, that where you hear the tapping on the window. So that's believed to be Henry Lambert's second wife's room. Her name was Mary Elizabeth, and she is said to still be there and be sort of the protector of the hotel. She gave birth to her children in the hotel, and she died there in 1926.
Oh, my. So is she the one tapping?
I don't know. People say, yeah, you can hear, maybe it's her tapping, and that you can also smell her rose-scented perfume in the room.
Oh, that's kind of nice.
I like that.
Oh, sure. And then room 18 is padlocked and nobody goes in it, because that's the room that is apparently TJ's. Whoa. And so they just let TJ live in his room and they try not to bother him.
Oh, yeah. Apparently. Didn't the guy say in the segment? Remember? He was like, as far as I'm concerned, that's his room.
Yeah.
I don't do anything.
Yeah. Yes, yes. So people who have been in the room say that it holds only a... And, you know, it might have been 18 that they went into, but they didn't say for sure that that was room 18. Mm-hmm. But then in all my reading... Mm-hmm. That's the room number. And then they heavily, of course, feature room 18 on Ghost Adventures. Mm-hmm. So the room holds only a bed frame, no mattress, a coat rack, a rocking chair, and a bureau. And then on top of the bureau is, of course, a bottle of Jack Daniels.
You gotta. Oh my gosh.
TJ is not cozy, but it doesn't matter because he has whiskey.
TJ's not cozy. Yeah. Okay, so then just a few more things. Apparently, people also see a dwarf. Oh, I don't know if this is the right thing to say. This is problematic, maybe.
Oh.
But they, a dwarf-like old man ghost who the hotel staff calls Little Imp.
Although that's what an imp is. It's like a mischievous presence. Yeah, that like gets into things and does weird stuff.
Oh, okay. So then maybe it is okay.
Okay. Okay.
I just think of Game of Thrones when I think of the word imp.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I think of it like a mischievous fairy almost.
Okay.
Oh,
okay. So that's our Game of Thrones thing then. Okay. That makes
sense. So he plays tricks and he laughs at the staff when he plays tricks on them. On one occasion, he was said to have stuck a knife into the floor between two owners of the old inn.
That's not a trick. That's assault. You can't do that.
But, so usually he's just blamed for things disappearing, and then they'll be found later in really weird locations. Okay, so then I was like, I'm interested to see, is the hotel leaning into this? Mm. Like, the Queen Mary is leaning into the haunting.
They're making money off it, honey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I went to the main site, and they mention nothing about hauntings.
Really?
Nothing. I like that. That's cool.
So they're I'm very shocked. Much like, just come to our, we have a great restaurant, we have a great bar, come visit our I think it's like 14 rooms that they have open. They're all named after different like Western people legends. Yeah. And just nothing, which kind of surprised me.
I think that's cool though.
Yeah.
And just makes it feel more valid.
Yeah, it makes it feel more authentic. If
that's
just like,
true.
Whatever.
That's true.
Yeah.
So you can still go there. A little about Jackie Little John before we end.
Yes,
so,
please.
Jackie Little John, who's the psychic that we were talking about, who saw the poker game and named TJ Wright. She was 1/4 Cherokee and born in Amarillo, Texas. And she is said to have received her psychic gift from her paternal grandmother, who was a Cherokee diviner in the 1800s.
Whoa.
Her daughter says that Little John passed the medicine pipe to her granddaughter, Misty Coburna, when she was in her, like, late teens, who lives in Albuquerque. And then she also has a son, Sterling Little John, who's a part of the Albuquerque metaphysical community.
Whoa.
So, like, her whole family is involved in this world, sort of.
In tune with spirits.
In tune with spirits, yes.
Cool.
Yeah, so she was a full-time psychic after she moved to Albuquerque in 1982. She read cards. She used a crystal ball. She did psychometry, where a psychic helps to locate a missing person by using vibrations, like holding something that belonged to that person and then using the vibrations or feelings they got from that object.
Wow.
And then after she was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and then her daughter said every time the show would be re-aired, too, she would get tons more clients.
Oh, wow. That's so nice, though.
Yeah. So she had, like, international clients.
Wow.
But unfortunately, she died from breast cancer, I believe, like, before she could even have a mastectomy.
Oh, no.
Her daughter said that in her mother's final days, her mother said, "The only thing that matters in this life is love. That's what it comes down to. That's all."
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of nice.
Well, that was super fun.
Oh,
and it's got me real excited for spooky summer.
Spooky summer. Don't worry. The next segment's spooky too.
Yes. And we read it at the top, but there's also some spookiness going over on Patreon.
Oh, yeah. Spook it up
check
over there.
Woo!
True story, I hate my hair. I have the thinnest, flattest, most baby fine hair that you have ever seen. I also have terrible skin allergies to hair products, and that leaves my scalp super itchy and unhappy. I have tried zillions of products with zero success, but I have recently found products that actually do what they say they're gonna do. I know, it's shocking.
I've started using Gemist. I took their quick 2-minute quiz, and their fancy schmancy algorithm matched me with the best shampoo and conditioner and a scalp balancing bar. I have to admit, I had no idea what a scalp balancing bar was, but I went for it anyway. It removed buildup and soothed the insane itchiness that I get from using hair care products. The shampoo gave my hair actual volume. Crazy, right? And the conditioner left my hair shiny and really soft and not like weighted down and gross. Also, the products smell really good. They put a lot of deliciousness into that scent. I also love the fact that Gemist is owned by a woman. You gotta support the ladies. Most awesome is that if you subscribe, you get 20% off. Right now, our listeners can give Gemist a try and get 20% off their shampoo and conditioner smart subscription. Smart subscribers already save 20% on each order, so this is an amazing deal. Do the math. And with free 2-day shipping, you can have it literally before this weekend. Just visit Gemist.com and get your personalized recommendation and enter mysteries at checkout for 20% off of your subscription and free 2-day shipping. That's Gemist.com, Gemist.com, and enter code MYSTERIES, MYSTERIES, at checkout to get the best hair of your life.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, my spooky brethren. It is time for the tale of the Hardin House. So I remember this segment as a kid because I couldn't believe it.
It's rather memorable.
It turns out I still can't.
Yeah.
So this is an unexplained segment, and it begins August 1968 in Richmond, Virginia. A woman named June Ferris. It's either Farris or Ferris. I've seen it spelt both ways, which made it delightful to search.
Oh, great.
So I'm not sure what the actual spelling is. We'll just stick with Farris. A woman named June Farris was having a strange reoccurring dream about a house that she had never set foot in or even seen. So Farris is interviewed, and she says that in the dream, she's in an upstairs bedroom. And when she leaves the bedroom, goes into the hallway, she turns to the right to a narrow staircase. She says that she knew that the house had a front staircase, but she never used that staircase in the dream. It was always the back staircase. She says that she turns to the left and goes through the kitchen around a refrigerator and stove that were on one wall. And I know that she's explaining this dream to show us how incredible it is that she dreamt about whatever house that this segment is about. But I have to say that so far this dream is super boring.
It's very underwhelming.
And I have a personal policy that I never want to hear about someone's dream And I call it the photograph standard. When it comes to dreams, just like photographs, if I'm not in them or someone isn't naked, I don't want to fucking know about it. So, this is so far a nightmare for me because this is the most boring telling of a dream I've ever heard.
I was like waiting for the scary part. And it was
me
like,
too.
And then I turned to the right.
I walked around.
And she really built that up because she kept talking about all of the turns she was making.
Yes.
And I assumed that they were going to lead somewhere. Silly us. So June has moved around the stove and the fridge. That's where we are in this very yes. compelling story.
Thick in it.
And then she says she gets a feeling of anxiety. Oh, and also the reenactment is very funny. It is this blonde woman whose hair is fully done.
Yes.
Full face of makeup, mm-hmm. as you do right before you go to bed.
Yeah, always.
She's in this very flimsy white cotton nightgown, mm-hmm. and all the lights are dim and blue and misty, and she's walking around with her mouth open and her eyes really wide.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the visual of the mist and everything totally reminded me of that, like, God, what is her name? Bonnie Tyler?
Yes.
The, like, Total Eclipse of the Heart video.
100.
Where she's, like, running around that mansion and there's all those curtains blowing and all
yes,
that stuff.
Yes, so same.
I was getting a lot of pop culture feels from this segment.
Yeah, I was like, I could see as a kid remembering this for a long
oh,
time.
Oh, yeah, they crushed it. So, anyway, back to this never-ending dream sequence. June says that in her dream, she would go out the kitchen door and onto the porch, and then she would wake up. So it's essentially a real estate porn dream. I get it. I'm here for it.
Yes.
But again, I'm not in it, and she has a nightgown on, so I'm not that interested.
Oh, this is a cool old house with a creepy staircase, and that's what mm-hmm. I learned about this dream.
Exactly. So June says that the dream continued for about once a month until they moved to Orlando, Florida 4 years later. Stack says that June and her family moved to Florida in 1972. 2 years later, she was driving through the small town of Claremont, Florida, when she came upon a house that, quote, enchanted her. Mm-hmm. Now, this house is gorgeous. It would enchant any single one of us. If we drove by, we would stop and look at it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So June said that she had always loved Victorian houses, so she called the realtor. Oh, the house was for sale. There was a for sale sign in the front yard. So she called the realtor and asked if she could go through it. June returned with a friend to look at the house, and once inside, June began to experience an eerie sensation. June says that she went through the downstairs first and then up the front staircase. She says she had a feeling of deja vu. So in the reenactment, her friend points out a back staircase and says, "Oh, look, more stairs. I wonder where they go." June says, "I know where they go." And then she recites the directions from her dream house.
Yeah.
Down the kitchen, past the stove, and onto the back porch. June's friend asks her how she knows where those stairs go. And June tells her she's dreamed about this house. So this woman, who just a couple of minutes ago told us she was super interested in Victorian houses, is now claiming that this is the house of her dreams because it has a set of servant stairs that lead to a kitchen.
Yep.
And that there's a stove in the kitchen. Like, okay.
The bar is low.
The bar is very low. Girl, everyone knows about servant stairs. There's always like a creepy back staircase. For someone who says that they know about this stuff, she's like, "Oh, I don't know where those mysterious stairs go." And June's like, "I do, because I dreamt it." It's like, or it's just obvious. Everybody knows that.
A common setup for a house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They go downstairs.
Yes. And then guess where servants go? In the fucking kitchen. So like it's a shocker. So June says that as they walk through the house, it definitely was the same house in the dream. She says she knew where everything was, every room, every closet. It was a really unusual experience. She says it wasn't scary. It was a feeling like she'd come home. Stack says that in March of 1978, June, her husband, and her three children moved into the old house. And I think that June is amazing, because this is the longest con ever.
Mm.
June has always wanted to live in a really nice Victorian, but I'm sure her husband was like, "We can't do it." So she started having these dreams of this dream house. And then she found this baller house, and she was like, "Oh my God, this is it. This is the dream mm-hmm. house. This is it. We've got to move here. It's preordained."
She manifested it.
I'm kidding. I'm dragging her. I believe that she believes that she dreamt this house. I dreamt this house, too. It's a dream house. There's a reason why they call it
that. It's an actual dream house.
Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, Stack says that almost immediately, odd things began to happen. Because you moved into a weird house that you dreamt about. You should have avoided it. Robin Grimes, June's daughter, is interviewed, and she says that her dad was working on their boat in the driveway, and the hitch was on a sawhorse stand. Robin says that it looked like someone had reached over, picked up the trailer hitch, and dropped it on the ground. She said that it happened several times afterwards, and it was so fast that you had to think to yourself, did I really see that? And Robin says that she was shocked. So Stack says that over the next few years, the Ferrises were witness to ever stranger occurrences. The extraordinary became ordinary, and the family suspected that they were not the only ones living in the house. And then they cut to a really creepy reenactment of a bunch of music boxes playing all at once.
Yeah. Didn't like that one.
That's why kids remember this.
Yes.
Ugh. Yeah. Oh, it's so scary. So, but if you were living in a haunted house, wouldn't you immediately remove all music boxes and dolls? Because they are fully always the creepiest thing in every single horror movie.
They're always haunted.
They're always haunted. They would be the first to go. They would have to go immediately.
One of them was like a doll that was like, hey,
yes.
Like, rotating around. It was freaky.
Horrible, horrible, horrible.
So Robin, again, says that she was 20 or 21, and she and her husband David were living at her mother's house. David woke her up in the middle of the night. And then in the reenactment, David wakes up and asks Robin, what is that? And Robin says, must be my music boxes. Like, this woman is super tempting the spirits here by having a full-on music box collection.
Oh, my God.
Obviously, the ghosts have to get down with creeping people out with music boxes. It's like what they have to do, you know?
You can't not.
So Robin says that David knew the house was haunted, and he was terrified. Then reenactment Robin walks into a legit music box room. That is its specific purpose. And there is this baby music box in the shot, and it's the creepiest thing ever. And it's in this frilly pink baby pajama or something. And its eyes are closed, and it's just rolling its head around and
it's around. It's so freaky. Like, even if it wasn't in the middle of the night and you were the one that wound it up, that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm. And whoever bought that is so mean. It's so mean. So Robin says that the switches were not on, that the music boxes were just wound up, and they were playing. So Robin says that was when she knew that they had a ghost. She says it wasn't scary to her. It was just kind of fascinating, and I love that.
Yeah.
She's like, you know, it was no TJ the ghost. This ghost is fine. Playing some tunes in the middle of the night. In 1985, Bob Vitter began dating June's younger daughter, Lori. And here comes our resident skeptic of the segment. Bob says that he was a firm disbeliever in ghosts, but after everything that has happened to him in that house, there is such a thing as ghosts, and there is a ghost in that house.
You gotta have the convert.
Gotta. Bob says a couple of nights before Halloween, he and Lori were in the parlor on the couch, and they heard the back door slam. Lori thought it was her mom, but Bob heard someone with boots coming across the kitchen and walking down the hallway. The person then stopped in the doorway to the parlor, and he had a feeling that whatever it was standing there watching them. The sound of boots continued down the hallway, and Bob followed the sound, but said he was really very, very scared. So cute. He says he was so terrified he couldn't even move. Oof. Stack says that by now everyone was convinced that the house was haunted, but no one had actually seen a ghost yet. And then in my notes I just have, damn, this is a long segment for a ghost. I feel like I've been watching it for 20 minutes. It did take up a lot of time in the episode,
yes,
admittedly. So Robin again says that she was walking up the stairway in the foyer of the house one day and she felt a cold chill. Then the reenactment uses this amazing 1990s CG to make a ghost materialize in front of Robin. Mm-hmm. Robin says that he was definitely a person, middle age or late 30s. She says it was just a cloud of smoke. It's there and then it's gone. But it was definitely a person.
Definitely a person.
A smoke person. Stack says that 3 months later, Bob Vitter had his own ghostly encounter. Vitter says that he went into the attic and saw a white vapor almost in the shape of a human. and as he took a step forward, the vapor came right at him and went through him. And he felt a cold blast of air and smelled the musty smell of the ghost.
What is with smelling ghosts?
You know what? I mean, if I were to have a ghost, I would hope that it would be lovely Marianne from the first segment who smelled like roses.
I was going to say, we had a rose-scented ghost. Now we got a musty ghost.
Yeah, a musty, stank-ass ghost. I don't want that. I want a rose ghost. So in October of 1985, Bob Vedder began looking into the history of the mansion. In the local library, he found volumes of old newspapers and discovered that the house was the location of a murder in which the owner of the house was gunned down in his own backyard. The victim's name was John Harden. Bob believes the ghost might be him. And oh my God, now it's an unexplained death segment. Mm-hmm. Because yes, ladies and gentlemen, you are getting two segments for the price of one in this segment.
I cannot believe.
Yes. It was a challenging week for old Allison here at the podcast.
Of course you would draw that card. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. So Stack then tells us that John Harden grew up in South Florida and at 18 married his high school sweetheart, Rita. And then they show this super cute photo booth picture of them. Rita literally has yarn bows in her pigtails. Mm-hmm. You remember like when people would tie yarn in their hair? Mm-hmm. I also, you know, I love a photo booth. So together they raised four children in Jacksonville, Florida. Rita Harden is interviewed. And in my notes, I'm like, so I guess this is happening now. Yes. We're doing a full-on John Harden segment. Yes.
This segment is two segments.
Things have taken a turn.
So Rita says that John was a good person. He cared about not just his family and friends, but everyone that touched his life. Stack says that after 14 years of marriage, John Harden dropped a bombshell on his wife. He told her that he loved her, but that he had to go away. He had to leave for a while. He said he had some problems, and he told her that when he got himself together, he'd be home, but he never came home. And I was like, oh my God, did he go to rehab? Like, did something happen? Did he have a drug problem? What kind of problems? Gambling? Was he on the run? Mm-hmm. What? No. Stack then says about a year and a half later, Harden remarried. So I guess his problem was that he needed to get away from his wife, Rita, and go have a new wife. Like, he could have just told her
that. And his four children.
Yes. Where is that? I mean, I wonder if something he was running from. But to already have another family like a year later is wild.
Well, he was running toward a 19-year-old. That's what he was running. He wasn't running from anything. He was running toward his 19-year-old girlfriend.
Great.
So Harden and his second wife purchased the Victorian mansion. 9 months later, John Harden woke to a disturbance outside of his bedroom window. Harden's pickup truck was engulfed in flames. It was later determined that the fire had been deliberately set. As Harden was putting out the fire, someone shot him in the chest with a single-barrel shotgun. He died less than an hour later, and no one was ever arrested in connection with the shooting. So this isn't fully accurate. John and his second wife did not purchase the Victorian mansion. His wife, strangely named Victoria, was willed the Victorian mansion.
Oh, fucking dream.
Yeah, right? Imagine being willed that house. That's a whole separate unsolved mystery. Who the hell's Victoria and what's her story? So they were selling that mansion, and they were living in the house while they were selling it. And also, he wasn't shot in the chest. I read multiple times in newspaper articles that he was actually shot in the back.
Mm. Which would make more sense.
Yeah. So Prentice Tyndall.
Whoa.
The best name ever. He is the chief of police of Claremont, Florida. And he said that there had been had there been a motive, they could have proceeded with the case and investigated a lot better. He says that several things were brought to his attention, but there was never a firm motive established. Special Agent Bruce. I don't know.
I like that. Episode title.
It's like Special Agent Madonna. He just has one name.
That's it. It's fine.
Shit. I'm sorry.
He dropped the last name.
I didn't write his name.
Sorry, I didn't get that. My bad. So Special Agent Bruce of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement says they had absolutely nothing after 3.5 months and a great deal of travel and interviewing literally hundreds of witnesses. They didn't have anything more at the end than they had when they started. He says on a scale of 1 to 10 of difficulty solving a crime, this is as close to a 10 as he's ever seen. Stack then asks the important questions. Could John Harden's spirit possibly be haunting his former residence?
Oh, my goodness.
Most importantly.
I mean, the most important questions, those hard-hitting questions. He says there do seem to be some amazing similarities between the ghost and John. According to his first wife, Harden was a loving and overly protective parent, and the Ferrises believe that the spirit in their house has the same nurturing attitude. Oh, geez. Okay.
Then they did not say how.
Well, they sort of
they do, and it's horrifying.
They do, but like, it's a pretty creepy way to show that you're loving and overprotective if you're a ghost.
Yeah, that.
So, AKA flipping terrifying if you're a small child.
I thought they were going to be like, and then the ghost saved someone's life.
No, not quite. Just creepily standing over a child. So June says that her grandson would wake up and the ghost man would be standing over him, which would obviously freak him out. Mm-hmm. June says it happened a couple times. And then one night, Robin went into her son's room and spoke to the ghost. And she told the ghost to leave Raymond alone and not to come back into the room again. And yeah, you guessed it. It worked.
Another someone given ghost orders.
This episode is called Reasoning with Ghosts.
Reasoning with Ghosts. Because you know what? Pat's onto it too. She's like, hey, stop dicking around with that chandelier, man. It's raining.
I'm tired. I gotta go to bed.
And the ghost was like, you know what? You're right. 6 times is too many times. My bad. When June Ferris learned the details of John Harden's death, she realized a connection with her dream. She learned that John Harden had run down the back stairs, through the kitchen, past the stove, and out the back door. And that was the same path that she took in her dreams. She felt like that there was something there that she should know. She said, there's a link, and he's trying to tell them what happened to him and help them find his killer.
That ghost.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Do you have something to say?
Just gonna say that ghost running down those back stairs past that oven is her fucking wet dream. Like,
oh my god,
she was like sploosh.
Ew,
she was. You can tell.
Oh gosh. So Robin says that she thinks he haunts to try to make a point to people that he can't go anywhere until the murder is solved. Stack says that in 1990. The Ferrises moved out of the mansion. The new owners also tell haunting tales of a restless spirit haunting the halls each night. Stack is then seen walking down a creepy hallway, and he says that when they were filming in the mansion in Claremont, the production crew encountered a number of unusual difficulties. Lights flickering on and off for no apparent reason, equipment fails, doors opening on their own, and a window in the attic shattered. The cause? Unknown. Stack says that perhaps it was a coincidence, or perhaps it was the spirit of John Harden, unable to rest until justice is served. Stack then tells us that the investigation into the murder of John Harden has now been reopened, and he's got a little smirk on his face. So I guess it was reopened because of June, or because of the recording of the segment? I don't know, but like he's like a little posturing, so it seems like had something to do with that.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Okay, so that's the end of that hour-long segment. So it seems like we have a ghost story and an unsolved murder on our hands. I'm going to start with the Harden House and then move to John Harden. People refer to the Harden House as Harden, H-A-R-D-E-N, but it's actually a misnomer. The name of the family that lived in the house was Harden with an I.
Oh.
And John Harden was with an I, not an E. But he's buried under the name Harden with an E in the Claremont Cemetery, and his birth year is incorrect tombstone as well. Yeah.
That's not great.
Did he, like,
so that's very strange.
Slightly change his identity when he got his new wife or something?
I don't think so.
Weird.
But it has caused some confusion. Also, there is a place called Harden House in Austin, Texas, that is a dormitory for women.
Interesting that I spent about 15 minutes on that page before I realized Harden.
Yes. Oh, my God. Of course.
So the family that bought the house, or the couple that bought the house from the Ferrises, are the Hatleys. And the Hatleys delightfully gave a lot of interviews, which was really fun to track their story through news articles through the years. So most of the information I'm getting is from the Orlando Sentinel. And before the show aired, there was an article in the Sentinel, and it said, Donna and Ken moved into the Victorian-style home in 1990 with full knowledge of the 1975 murder of Claremont High School graduate John Harden. Ken Hatley, a music producer and the project manager for Universal Studios Halloween Horror Nights.
Fun.
A chilling extravaganza that features haunting creatures, terrorizing tunnels, and hundreds of live rats crawling over a live woman in a coffin.
Okay.
So good old Ken is well-versed in creepy.
He knows.
So throughout their first year, the Hatleys said that they noticed more than the occasional sound or strange occurrence. Quote, we'll hear tappings, sounds like someone is walking down a hall, things like that. Not only us, we've had a whole full table of people that have heard it as well. Claremont Police Chief Prentice Tyndall said, quote, we worked on that case nearly every day for nearly a year. Several law enforcement departments worked on the Harden case, going as far as Atlanta, Georgia, searching for evidence, but no clues ever pointed to an individual suspect, though police still maintain at this time, a list of several possible suspects. And then the article says, the case caught the ear of Unsolved Mysteries producer Nikki Wine last spring during a business conversation with Hatley, the music producer. As Hatley told Wine the history of the new home, Wine's curiosity was piqued. After several weeks researching the case herself, the decision was made to use the Harden murder on the television series. Television crews rolled into Claremont, prepared the house for a 5-day shooting schedule. City officials gave approval for the crews to burn a truck in front of the home for one of the scenes. At the time, Prentice Tyndall said, the case is very actively open right now. We just hope something will turn up. So when Donna and Ken bought the house, they knew about the murder, but they claimed that they knew nothing of the hauntings. And at first, they say they were skeptical. Then their attitude changed. Quote, this thing is real, man, said Ken Hatley. Donna and Ken said they were amazed at how similar the Ferrises' descriptions were to their own experiences. Both the Hatleys and members of the Ferris family described seeing a vision, then experiencing a cold rush of wind as the presence vanished. You could always, quote, you could always tell when he was around, said Ken. It would be cold and there would be a smell, a cross between ammonia, sulfur, and a smelly sock.
Oh, oh my God, that's three of the worst smells.
Oh my, yeah. Smelly sock.
Doorknobs twisted spontaneously. Mm-mm. An outdoor swing violently flies to and fro on the calmest of nights, and an indoor rocking chair cautiously rocks back and forth on its own.
No, I'm a big no on the doorknobs.
Mm-hmm. No. Donna Hatley said, I've never discussed any of this with June Ferris, yet the way she described it is exactly the same as we've experienced. Though the home remained silent while the Hatleys watched the segment the night that it aired, Ken Hatley said a presence appeared earlier in the day and was seen by one of his business associates. The apparition materialized on more than one occasion, sometimes in front of visitors. The spirit made itself known during an extended business visit in 1991 by London producer Michael Anthony. Shaken by the sighting, Anthony ran to Donna Hatley, who, along with her husband, began praying for Anthony's protection as he returned back to the second floor. Moments later, Ash and Anthony rushed back downstairs to report seeing not only the spirit, but a host of angels marching through the halls.
Mm. Marching angels?
Anthony described the spirit in the same way as everyone who has seen it. It is a man wearing blue jeans and a denim shirt. As an aside, I've seen some articles that say that John Harden was wearing a flannel shirt when he died. And some people say it was denim.
I like the Canadian tuxedo ghost better. I think we should roll with that.
I love that. Also, a host of angels marching through the halls makes me think that maybe it wasn't a ghost. Maybe Michael Anthony was like... on something.
Having a trip.
Maybe there was some drugs.
Maybe he was tripping his balls off. I don't know. Whatever. So during a dinner party in 1992, one guest kept cracking jokes about the alleged presence of the ghost until an apparition appeared. It was the same man in the denim tuxedo. Eventually, the Hatleys were driven to call investigators from the Center for Paranormal Studies in Gainesville.
But paranoia would also be a good title for them.
The investigators found, this is shocking, evidence of a presence. Hmm. And they said they managed to snap a photo of the spirit as well. Let me say, for the record, I searched high and low for this photo.
Oh, I believe that you did.
And in my opinion, if it doesn't exist on the internet, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So, quote, I certainly think the Hatley House certifies as a genuine haunted house, said Dr. Andrew Nichols, a psychologist with the center. He said the photograph had some of the same electromagnetic effects that occur in genuine hauntings and is consistent with other hauntings and paranormal phenomena. Nichols said that the Hatley House is one of 24 haunted houses in Florida certified by his and other groups. In another article from the Orlando Sentinel that came out a year after the episode, they interviewed Donna Hatley. Quote, in the last 6 months, there have been no sightings. There have been very few happenings, if any. It has been very interesting. He's not here. Whatever was here is not here when I'm here. So after the show aired, maybe the ghosts just want to be on TV, you know? Just need a little bit of attention.
Same whore.
The article goes on to say the Hatleys aren't planning for trick-or-treaters this weekend because it goes against their spiritual beliefs. Quote, last year, I didn't really have a choice, Donna said. There were so many children mesmerized about the place. I didn't want to disappoint them, and I didn't want them to be scared. Trick-or-treaters haven't been the only visitors to the Hatley's haunted house since their friendly ghost became public a year ago. Apparently, a woman just walked into their kitchen one day when Donna was in the kitchen.
No.
So she walked in and Donna asked her what she was doing. And the woman said, oh, I'm moving away. I'm moving out of Florida, but I just had to come inside the house first.
No.
Like, okay, well, hello. It's not your house.
This is my house.
And then the article goes on to say, among those who have recently dropped by unexpectedly since the television aired was the slain man's widow, Victoria. Although the Central Florida woman refused to cooperate with television producers, she told the Hatleys that she felt compelled to return to the house. Quote, she told me that she had never been back to the house since the murder, so I asked her to come in and we went through the whole house. Victoria said she always wanted to know if John, the ghost, had come here. Why hadn't he visited her? That was her biggest upset. Mm-hmm. So sad.
That is sad.
I read some unsubstantiated stories on the internet that I think are bullshit, basically, because I couldn't corroborate them with any news articles.
And because you're Allison.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I love a ghost story. Yeah. I don't believe in ghosts, but I love a story. I'm here for it, and I love it. I really enjoy doing these. But it's one thing to have people interviewed on newspaper articles, and it's another thing to have a website like spookygarbagestory.com. Say, like, one time a girl lived there. You know what I'm saying? It's just, like, it's just garbage. Yeah. Like, you can say anything on the internet. I need sources at the bottom of your weird, gross website that's got neon green lettering all over it.
Always the neon green, honey, on a black background.
God. Mm-hmm. I've never seen so many freaking jack-o'-lanterns in my life. Like, a jack-o'-lantern on every page. You get a jack-o'-lantern. You get a jack-o'-lantern. I get it. It's a ghost story. So there's one unsubstantiated story that there was a little girl living in the house, and I'm not sure if it's supposed to be Robin, but they said that this little girl would have night terrors every single night, and when the parents went into her room to check on her, she was never in her room. She was always standing at the top of the back staircase.
No, thank you.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and then there was another unsubstantiated story that said that an elderly couple lived in the house, and when their grandson came to stay for the weekend, he fell down the back stairs and had a severe head injury, and when the grandfather came out to see what the sound was, the grandfather slipped on his blood and also fell down the stairs and had a severe head injury. But again, like, when you're on spookygarbagestory.com and there's no sources, it's just, I think, lies. I don't like that.
Yeah.
And then it removes credibility. For somebody that's a skeptic, you see these people, they're human beings, they believe this thing, you respect them, you respect their stories,
Okay, so this is before, this is the last part of the haunting, and then I'll move to John Harden. So I read a 1994 article, and it had a cute little anecdote. So it was the fifth year that Ken Hartley was running the Universal Studios Horror Nights, and everyone in his teen had finally found out that he had lived in a haunted house. So of course, everybody was just teasing him and, you know, super into it. If you work on a horror project, really into that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So Amy Henry, the assistant director of special events and entertainment for the park, said, quote, "If you had a haunted house, where else would you work?" And then she joked about Hatley's house during an interview, and she said, quote, "They have no control over their ghost." The quote is, "We control our frights here," she said, at the precise moment the office lights spontaneously increased in brightness, went nearly black, and then brightened, and then dimmed again. Amy Henry paused, then glanced up. "Then again," she said, trailing off. So cute. So I have a little bit about John Harden. Apparently, Claremont, Florida is a town of around 35,000 people, and it's close enough to Orlando to take advantage of the tourism industry of nearby Disney World, Universal Studios, all of those other parks. Murders are infrequent. When a homicide does take place, Claremont has a success rate of almost 100%. Wow. In fact, the only unsolved murder to happen in Claremont is that of John Harden.
Wow, okay.
So at the time of the murder, the Harden family, husband, wife, and 9-month-old baby boy, had been in Claremont for about a year. Victoria Harden had apparently inherited the property and entered into a contract to sell it. In the meantime, the little family moved down from Jacksonville and stayed in the old house.
So he left his wife and had a baby, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it gets even... He named his baby John, and he already had another son named John with Rita.
Men do that sometimes, and it is so weird.
It's so weird. It's so weird. And Hatley was 32 when he died, and I think Victoria was barely 20 years old. So John Harden had opened a commercial industrial refrigeration business in Claremont. He named it Mango Refrigeration after his wife. He did business with the city of Claremont, and he did business with local restaurants. More than likely, he also did business with some of the many fruit growers, processors, and distributors that flourished the Southlake County at the time. On the night of his death, a Saturday night, he received an emergency call from a restaurant in Groveland. So he and his wife and baby all piled into the truck and went out to the Wyatt Drive-In. E.B. Hart Jr. was the proprietor of the restaurant. Hart says that Harden, quote, "worked on my chicken machine."
Oh.
"That's what I used to fry the chicken. It needed a part. Oh, yeah, it was legitimate on my part, at least." The next day, his wife came over and said he'd been killed. So for a long time, people speculated, was this call like kind of a red herring to get the family out of the house? But apparently it wasn't. So while the Hardens were fixing the chicken machine, someone cut the telephone lines to the house back in Claremont. The Hardens returned from Groveland at about 10:45 p.m. Harden pulled his work truck into the driveway, and it's pretty close to the back stairs that lead to the porch. This article says if the Hardens would have taken the back stairs onto the porch, they may well have walked by John Harden's killer. So shortly after returning home, Harden took a shower in the second floor bathroom. He walked back into the bedroom, looked out the window, and saw his truck was on fire. He went out to fight the fire dressed in jeans and a flannel shirt, the same as the ghost. He grabbed a fire extinguisher on the way. It apparently was not an extensive fire because two neighbors who had rushed out to help had the fire subsequently extinguished by the time the fire truck had arrived. But it's not really clear who first noticed that John Harden was laying by the area of the fire, seriously injured. And it's not clear if Harden had already been shot by the time the neighbors arrived. Mm. The emergency call to dispatchers came in as an explosion. And news accounts indicate that Victoria Harden thought that the truck had exploded. So they don't know if the explosion was actually gunshot. The timeline is kind of jumbled. Fire personnel were on the scene 1 minute after the call came in, according to a police report. The shots that killed Harden were fired from the bushes that are right by the back stairs, and the pellets from the shotgun blast are still embedded on the wall of the house next door. The initial police report indicated that a 20-gauge shotgun was found in the bushes the day after the murder. And that matching shotgun pellets were found in Harden on autopsy. Harden was shot in the back. Harden was transported to Southlake Memorial Hospital and died there soon after at about 11:25 p.m. The article says, Harden's killer had an easy escape route. While there's no way of knowing where the killer went immediately after shooting Harden, the house is only 2 blocks from Lake Mineola, right about where an old boat ramp used to be. Some have said that Lake Mineola would be too big to row across. I looked up, but I read on Sitcoms Online from a user named Killarney Rose that there's an easy highway access to the house with State Road 50 just a few blocks away that runs east and west, and just a mile or so away, Highway 27 runs north and south, and those two intersect just a couple of miles from the house, so either could have provided a fast getaway. There appears to be no motive, which is bananas. Like the article said, there are some suspects, but they can't get a clear motive.
Mm-hmm.
John Hardin was a businessman, and he did abandon his first family. So in my opinion, that's a lot of motive. And we don't know anything about Victoria. She could have had an ex or a relative who didn't like the fact that a 31-year-old man got an 18-year-old Victoria pregnant. Also, Rita's interview baffled me because John flat out walked out on her.
I know,
her
and
the
she
kids.
Seemed so sad.
I mean, she was so sad.
Like she loved him still.
Yes. Yeah.
Like she didn't seem mad.
The reenactment was very loving as well. I was like really surprised.
Yeah.
Yes. That's why I thought he was going to rehab and not leaving her for another woman.
Yeah, me too.
It had been 17 years but at the time of this interview, and she's tearing up, and she wanted everyone to know what an attentive and loving father he was. And not only did he walk out on her and the children, but he moved 170 miles away. Sadly, Rita died in 2011, but she had an amazing life after John blew her off for a teenage bride. So good for her. Because I love when someone gets a great second act.
Yes.
So she had a huge family, lots of grandchildren, traveled the world. She had a wonderful life.
Good.
I did find a totally bananas theory that was quickly torn apart by reality, but it's an interesting revenge story, so I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it anyway. A website called spookhunters.com has a theory that maybe John and Rita's oldest son, Timothy, killed John.
What?
So the website says that on November 3rd, 1991, just days after the Unsolved Mysteries episode featuring the Hardin House haunting was aired, Timothy Paul Hardin died.
Oh.
Timothy was John's oldest son with Rita. Timothy would have been 13 when his father was murdered. Timothy would have been witness to his father leaving, and as the oldest, would have been there to help his mother pick up the pieces of a broken marriage and a broken promise of a return. Undoubtedly, the news of a new marriage and a baby got back to Rita and John's first family. Timothy would have felt that John threw the family away like trash to start another one, even naming the firstborn the same name as one of his younger siblings. So this person believes that Timothy snuck out on a Saturday evening, made his way to John's house, and accidentally killed him. So the writer theorizes that Timothy took his own life after the UM airing because he thought he was going to get caught.
Aww.
However, there are Swiss cheese level holes in this story. Namely, how did a 13-year-old boy travel over 100 miles to get to John's house and then get home again before his mother discovered that he'd been gone? Also, there is no record that I can find online that says how Timothy died. So it could have been a car accident or cancer for all we know. His obituary just reads, beloved son to Rita and Johnny, and loving older brother to Lisa, John, and Lori. Tim went to await our arrival in heaven on November 3rd, 1991. After this theory was posted, the users on Sitcoms Online just eviscerated it. Meg the Egg's response was particularly humorous.
Always.
So initially, after the airing, Claremont police were optimistic that the show would rekindle memories and bring new evidence. Although the producers said the show had the largest audience of any Unsolved Mysteries episode so far, the police said that no new evidence appeared.
Huh.
The show didn't bring a single call to the Claremont police station.
Weird.
Claremont Police Chief Prentice Tyndall said, I didn't get one call all day, but I sure do hope that someone remembers something. Unsolved Mysteries field producer Kathleen Cromley said at the time that 80% of the unsolved police cases used for segments in the series eventually are solved as a result of the television airing. So I read that June Farris passed away. I wasn't able to find Robin Grimes. Ken Hatley is no joke. He has really been in the recording industry for decades. His resume is bananas. I pulled some info from LinkedIn. And it says, quote, Ken Hatley has written and produced soundtracks for such major directors as Robert Wise, George Romero, Ralph R. Clemente, Lou Retta, and many others.
Wow.
He had many major artists' recordings of his work, including The Four Tops, Richie Havens, Razzie Bailey, Charlie Daniels, Melanie, and others. He produced and managed the late actor David Carradine, and represented Johnny and June Cash in some film projects. Mm-hmm. Donna is an artist in her own right. She's a painter. Donna and Ken are still together. It's been 44 years, and they are super adorable. Aww. They seem to have a really great life, and they still live in Harden House.
Wow.
And that's the spooky story of the Harden House.
Oh, my gosh. Slash a murder.
Yeah.
Slash a murder.
Oh, my gosh.
That's... And who killed him?
Yeah, I do not know.
That's weird. There, I feel there's something shady we don't know about.
All these years later, to not even have any kind of... It couldn't have been that professional because they left the gun behind.
Yeah.
Like, who does that? What professional-level killer who has the smarts to set this car on fire to create a distraction to bring him downstairs to make him an easy target? Who would leave the gun behind?
Yeah, that is weird.
So, I don't know, but it's... Oh, man. It's a whodunit. And I don't think... unless there's a deathbed confession, I don't think we're ever going to know who killed him.
That's crazy.
Wow. Well, good job. I know that one really wasn't what you expected.
No. Sometimes they're not, but it was a lot of fun. I had a really good time covering it. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, you know that I love to be creeped out. We love our ghosties and our aliens and the paranormal and haunted houses. We're here for all of it. And if you're like me, which you probably are if you're listening to this, you love a ghost story too. And that's why I have a podcast I think y'all will love. It's called Scary Time. Scary Time is a weekly podcast where an independent creator comes on and tells stories of the paranormal, ghosts, monsters, hauntings, creepy places, enchanted objects, aliens, and more. The best part is if you like the creator of that episode, you can follow them for more great content. So it's a great way to find new podcasters and new podcasts that you'll love. When I checked out Scary Time, I was so pleasantly surprised to see some creators that I already knew and loved, and I found a bunch more that I didn't even know about. I recently listened to Strange Weather and Vengeful Witches by Fireside Phantoms, and it was so good. It's so spooky and so interesting. It's a lot of fun. You can find Scary Time on any podcast app, so check it out, if you dare.
Okay, Allison, great job as always. Hope you're not too scared, listeners. We hope you can curl up under a blanket and go to sleep without any nightmares, dream about any houses or TJ, and come back next week for part two of episode 7, where we're covering a missing segment and a fraud segment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you want to support the show and get extra content, you can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast. And if you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. And don't forget that we're going on our summer hiatus from July 26th to August 25th, but patrons will still get short stacks and some extra content. So they'll have an episode every week for the break. And if you're worried about missing the three of us, this is a great way to fill that void. Also, we currently have over 50 Patreon short stack episodes on there. So if you become a patron right now, you could binge it all and have like over 40 hours of content to listen to. We could just become your full-time job if you want. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005 Portland, Oregon 97293. And keep sending us your stories for listener short stacks. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story or a cold case or nostalgia you have surrounding the show, we would love to hear it and maybe read it on an episode. And last, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a 5-star review or just a 5-star rating is so helpful. And please tell a friend about the show. Don't forget that for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization, and this month's is the Epilepsy Foundation. And we will see you next week for part 2. We love ya.
We love you so.
Stay spooky.
Bye.
Bye.
And then it ends with a fraud segment of Dr. John Anderson.
A frog right. segment.
It's a frog segment.
Ribbit.
Ribbit.
All right. Okay, get ready for some spooks.
Let's hop on in.
Spook.
Get it? Frogs.
Get it. I got it.
I'm on
it.
Frogs and you guys are on ghosts.
She's already on frogs.